welcome to this Tuesday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We hope your day is going well. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we have a busy show today. In the second half, we'll look back at the life and legacy of Vice President Dick Cheney with Wyoming journalist and filmmaker Jeff O'Gara, who revisits his documentary, A Heartbeat Away. It's a rare first-person reflection from one of the nation's most influential leaders. Plus, we'll learn about a sweet solution from Montana, turning apples into cider to help keep bears away. We begin Main Street today with Lindsay Brewer, founder of the Great Plains Children's Museum, a new nonprofit initiative in Fargo that's reimagining what play and connection can look like on the prairie. And after years of supporting startups and entrepreneurs, Lindsay is turning her focus towards families, envisioning a space where children can explore and parents can exhale. With exhibits that blend creativity, science, and the natural world, the museum's vision includes everything from a hands-on seed-to-table farming experience to a make-believe mini town and makerspace, and we'll talk about her inspiration, the community effort behind it, and what's next for the project. Lindsay, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. I appreciate you asking me to join you here.
I am glad that you are with us. And what inspired you, Lindsay, to start the Great Plains Children's Museum? And when did the idea first take shape?
Yeah, so first and foremost, the primary indicator or like inspiration behind all of this is I have three kids. I'm a mom of three children, all age six and under. And just in the past year and a half or so, I ended up having to become a stay-at-home mom again after my third was born, and my daycare spot ended up being backed up by 2 months for my baby from maternity leave. And so I was like, well, this is a sign. I need to take a step back and stay home with the kids again. After spending probably about 3 months or so hitting up all the typical spots around the city of Fargo and Moorhead and even all the way out into Fergus Falls, I realized there was a huge gap in having a space that my kiddos could enjoy on a daily, regular basis that was affordable and it was playful and safe and it could accept a big age range of kids. So some spaces really serve babies, some serve the older kids, but there really wasn't something that could cover our whole family. And that's really where I saw the big gap in the community and why I was like, a children's museum is something that our community needs desperately.
So with your background, you've supported startups and creative ventures prior. How did that experience now shape what you're trying to build here, really from the ground up?
Yeah, so because I've had so many years of experience, basically what I've discovered is identifying gaps and then helping people either build it from the ground up or supporting their journey. I took all that experience of me creating and building with others and decided it was time that I did it for myself. Those skills that I developed over the years of working with founders and entrepreneurs in the for-profit space really helped me refine my focus on how can we create a nonprofit museum, but think about it in a way that a for-profit needs to, so that way it's sustainable and financially viable for years to come. Notoriously, museums are loss leaders. They don't make money or they rely really heavily on federal funding. And we know right now that's a bad place to rely on funding. And so I've been taking a lot of my for-profit mindset to think about how can we make sure that a nonprofit children's museum doesn't get impacted when things like government shutdowns happen.
And you've now achieved your 501c3 not-for-profit status, is that right?
Yep. So we had some sort of crazy miracle. Somebody was looking out for us. We applied on February 2nd of 2025 and we got approved on February 28th.
Wow. Light speed.
Yeah. So absolutely crazy. Everyone I've talked to in the nonprofit world is like, it's unheard of. It usually takes 6 to 9 months. And for us, it's been both a blessing and a curse because we thought that we would have 6 to 9 months to plan things before we got going. But in less than 20 something days, we got our approval and we were like, well, we're not going to look a gift horse in the mouth. It's time to just start running.
I've heard you say, Lindsay, connection to the promised village. What does that mean?
Yeah. So when you become a parent, oftentimes people say it takes a village to raise kids. And that harkens back to the ages of when communities actually lived together in village groups and we had nuclear families. So your grandma and your dad and everybody all lived together. Nowadays, that's just not a reality. Most families come from either disconnected or broken homes, or they live in different states. And so, having a village of support, whether it's from your direct family and relatives or people in your community, doesn't necessarily exist anymore. And for many people, that's something that they desperately want. So, creating this promised village is my hope to create a space where other care providers, families, parents, grandparents can connect to one another, in hopes of creating those stronger bonds that, like right now, we're experiencing the removal of SNAP benefits essentially. Like, how do we come together and we support people in our community as a village when things are hard? Or if somebody is having a baby, how do we create a meal train for them so that way when they have the baby, they don't have to cook? And so that all comes from that basis of how do we create connections to one another, regardless if you're family or not.
What's your vision for the Great Plains Children's Museum? What might it, excuse me, what might it look like? The size, the layout, and the kinds of experiences you're hoping families can have?
Yeah, so the museum, when it first started, was purely focused on how do I create this amazing space that my kids, regardless of their age, can go and experience and play. Over the past year, what we discovered and we learned from the parents and caregivers in our community is that the museum is going to be a big core piece, but it's actually going to be much bigger than that. And I'll get to that in just a second. But in order to reach this bigger goal, our hope is that we can create a children's museum space that is right sized for our community. What that means is we need something that's at least 30,000 square feet so that way people have space to roam. And then we also need to be able to have a space that has a variety of age range groupings. So we might have a seed to table type of exhibit, which explores everything from raising livestock, planting seeds, all the way up to harvesting, as well as cooking and culinary and all of those pieces. But within a space, there would be different pockets to support different age groups. So think about an area that's safe for babies and crawling within the same space that your 6, 7, 8-year-old could be running around and climbing. And parents don't have to worry about, don't touch that, don't do that, please don't run over the babies, and creating that safety within exhibits. We have essentially 6 core exhibits that we want to create within the museum, which cover a variety of things from sensory, and it's called sensations with play on words. And then we have our tiny town, like you mentioned. And so we'll have a bunch of different exhibits that cover a variety of topics that kids will be able to explore and rotate different topics. So it's going to be a big space. And with nature as a core priority or natural play, we also want to have somewhere between 15 and 20 acres because we want to have a very immersive outdoor space. So that way we can have kids experiencing both indoors and outdoors year round.
This sounds like a big undertaking. Lindsay, how are you doing? How are you coming along?
Yeah, so over the past year, we've been able to raise somewhere over $25,000. Everything has been done basically by a complete volunteer board. Most of our events have been on a pop-up basis. We are in true startup mode where everything right now is run out of my garage. So I have loads of things in my garage, and we're lucky that we found a place to store some of the things over the winter so I can park in there. But we're in pure startup mode right now. What we're looking towards for 2026 is we're ready to start professionalizing and getting boots on the ground to get those real big commitments to make this happen. And we have some really great warm leads on those pieces, but we can't obviously share the details of those. But we're very hopeful on the progress we're making because when we think about these projects, on a national average, they can take up to 10 years to come to fruition. I have 10 years to wait around. I got a six-year-old. I want it to happen before she's too old. And so we're really pushing to try and get it done as quickly as we can. And we're looking good on that front.
I'm enjoying my conversation with Lindsay Brewer. She's the executive director and founder of the Great Plains Children's Museum. Lindsay, I am sure you've had a chance to do some research. Who's getting it right relative to children's museums in the ones that you've come across?
Yeah, so some really good ones in the region that people look to oftentimes are the one in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. That one is really impressive in that they were able to retrofit an old school. So they got a school building donated and the inside of it, they basically took the classrooms and turned them into a tiny town. So one is a mechanics bay, one is a restaurant. And they have this amazing space that because of the way that they situated and retrofitted the building and raised funds, they created enough funding to be able to support themselves in a way from an endowment that gives them the ability to have more accessible fees and things like that. So that's something that I really look to in how can we set ourselves up for success financially. And then as we look at the other types of children's museums out in across the nation, the Minnesota Children's Museum, I look to for the way that they structured their main street, where they have actually like, it looks like a tiny street and buildings inside of this crazy large facility. And then looking further out into other industries, not just refining ourselves to just children's museums, because I want to make sure that we have repeatable value. I've been looking at things like the gathering space down in, I believe it's in Tennessee. They have these amazing outdoor structures by Monstrum out of Denmark. And that's something I've been exploring a lot is how do we implement artistic and creative ways of developing our space. So we're supporting the whole being of the child and the care provider, where it's not just about all the pieces that we can play with, but it's also about the playful presentation of the space. So I imagine with the outdoor space, I really want to have kind of three different beautiful play structures, one being a pheasant because our logo is a pheasant, medium-sized one being a bison, because obviously an ode to North Dakota, and then a large one being a Viking ship because of our Nordic roots. And so there's a lot of really cool pieces that we're pulling from aligned industry as well as parallel industries in order to make sure that our children's museum is unique to our area.
It seems to me that Fargo may be on the larger end of communities that does not have a children's museum across the country. In my experience, small town Riverton, Wyoming, 10,000, a great children's museum with very involved folks doing their best to try to make it fly. Cheyenne, Wyoming, they are like you. They are building up and now ready to almost open their children's museum, and it's been a process. Other museums that I'm familiar with bridge between wanting to work with governmental agencies or not, making it just a nonprofit. Have you thought about partnering with Cass County, the city of Fargo, West Fargo, or those types of things? Or is this something that is better served by being a private nonprofit and you're on your own?
Yeah, so this kind of gets at that aspect I mentioned of the bigger picture. So our first and foremost priority, obviously, with the museum is to create an amazing space where kids can play and parents can connect. However, as we reached out to parents, what we heard is there's a gap and a disconnect between the resources and things that they need to support their journey as care providers and as supporting the kiddos in their lives. So what we've actually started to work towards is what we're calling a family resource hub. And this hub actually becomes a way for us to partner with other existing entities and still maintain our nonprofit status and keep ourselves kind of in that secure bubble so that way we don't have to rely on federal or government funding. So what this might look like in practice is even though we want, say, a 30,000 square foot facility, our facility might actually be a little bit bigger, whether that's within the same building or additional buildings near us that could house things like one of the things we're exploring is a nature school. So we think about childcare, which is a big gap, but then allowing them to be able to explore those types of things and be attached to a children's museum is a huge benefit. And then on top of that is we are going to try and co-locate potentially with other service providers or resource providers that support the whole family. So think about the Safe Kids ND office, which is in the lower level of the Sanford Children's Urgent Care over on 13th. That is down in the basement of where you take your kids to when they're sick or when they're getting vaccines. And oftentimes I'm in and out. But what if that was co-located at the Children's Museum? So we're thinking about how we can co-locate and partner with organizations that are basically bringing the amazing resources that are already there into the space, and the Children's Museum becomes that magnet. So we keep parents and families in, and then we also draw in the resources into the same campus and location, and then it becomes this osmosis effect of parents and caregivers coming in and then going out to resources that maybe they didn't know exist, or perhaps there was a stigma around it. So that's how we're tackling a partnership challenge, is that we may have some sort of umbrella entity with the Family Resource Hub that the museum and the school and everything falls underneath, but we want to maintain the Children's Museum as its own kind of sanctuary within that.
It sounds to me, Lindsay, that you are really open to maybe out of the box ideas here to get sustainability, to open the museum. So that begs the question, folks have ideas. How can families and educators and even local businesses get involved now on the ground floor with you to be part of the story?
Yeah, so we have a ton of different needs and ways that people can get involved. A big gap right now that we have is just support in people hours and time. We have an amazing board of directors, but we need to add more people to that board that can help bring in professionalized skills and talents, whether that's nonprofit governance, or capital campaign support. And so we need more people with amazing minds who are smarter than me and smarter than the rest of our board to be able to bring those ideas in and help bring them to life. And then on top of that, we need to start figuring out how do we lock in those partnerships with businesses. What we've started doing is creating non-binding letters of intent from organizations that can help create a little bit of security and confidence from potential donors in that, oh, look, they've gotten 15 letters of intent from various business entities or partners. I feel way more comfortable making a large landmark gift because of that, because we know that they're going to have sustainable revenue. So we are working kind of through the step-by-step process of we need help. We need people, we need partners, and we also eventually we need place. So the place space becomes in where maybe somebody is really inspired and they want to donate the land, or they want to donate a building with the land. And so those are the big core pieces right now that people can support us is people, partner, and a place.
When I think about a facility, of course, geography becomes important about where you locate. Fargo's relatively large. West Fargo increases size. Horace, all kind of one unit here. Is the place where this is important to you? Have you thought about all of this in your mind of where can this be placed so that the most can benefit?
Yeah. So in having a background in food insecurity and accessibility and things like that, as I've considered where the specific facility will end up, I met with all of the cities early on in order to understand what is happening with development, what is going to be built in the next 5-10 years, like thinking about the off ramps of the highway, as well as where is the MAT bus stops. And as I've looked at those things and planning things out, we obviously have challenges in thinking about access. So how do people access things, whether it's with public transportation, driving, thinking about snow removal, but then also considering like we are looking for a decent amount of land. And ideally, I want to have something that has somewhat mature trees if we want to have nature involved, which is a big ask for North Dakota. But through exploring all those pieces, we kind of have in our minds where we think things might land. But again, it's all going to depend on the potential of either donation or in-kind support from our partners. And that's going to be a really big challenge for us of making that decision, because everybody has an opinion on where we should be.
Have faith-based communities potentially been a part of this in your vision?
So as of right now, we don't have a specific tie to any faith-based communities. One of the things that we want to try and maintain is being a neutral party. So the specific entity of Great Plains Children's Museum doesn't align itself to a specific faith-based belief, but we think that obviously faith-based communities are very charitable in the way that they give and they support. So right now there is no direct tie, but we just want to be welcoming to as many people as we can.
Have you allowed yourself to think about or imagine opening day for the museum, Lindsay?
Yes, all the time.
What do you think about?
So for me, I think about kind of the grand entrance and just the amount of kids that I imagine rushing in. Like a lot of it is me imagining my own kids coming into the space and their little touches of artistry, or the thought of having a children's advisory committee in helping with the design of the space, and those kids coming into the space thinking like, oh my gosh, they actually listen to my like crayon drawing designs, and this is a part of it. In my mind, because we have this fantastical pheasant logo that the original version I drew myself, and then we had a designer fix it. But imagining that when people walk in, I really hope that we can have like an art piece of that hanging from the ceiling in like stained glass. And I just picture that in my mind of watching all the kids come in and the parents just in awe of the space and being able to just run free and not have to worry about, you know, them breaking anything or asking you to buy anything or whatever. It's just, it's that, I imagine the deep breath that parents need, that exhale you mentioned is something that I dream about all the time, and it keeps me going.
If people want to learn more, whether it's to follow your progress, how they can participate, how can they do that?
Yeah, so we do have our website, which is live, and that is, it's kind of a short version of our name, but it's just Great Plains, and then CM, so Charlie Mike, and that gets you to greatplainscm.com, which has a ton of information about everything that we've been working on. And the other good way to learn more is to just reach out to myself. I answer all the emails individually. So if people have questions, I'm happy to have a coffee connect or a virtual meeting. I can be reached at theinfo@greatplains.com, or they can reach out to me directly through the website too.
Well, Lindsay, it was a pleasure meeting you at the Fargo Zoo. Not every day do I meet such great and interesting people at the zoo, but boy, I sure did with you. And you've been my guest, Lindsay Brewer, the executive director and founder and board chair of the Great Plains Children's Museum in Fargo, an inspiring new project aiming to give children room to explore and parents space to connect. And you can learn more, as she said, by getting involved at greatplainscm.com. Lindsay, best wishes. Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thanks so much, and I hope you have a playful rest of your week.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
Still to come on Main Street, a conversation with filmmaker Jeff O'Gara. He filmed a 2015 documentary on Vice President Dick Cheney, and on the news this morning that Cheney has now passed away, we reflect with the filmmaker on Cheney's legacy. That's ahead on Main Street, right after this news. Main Street continues on this Tuesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and in 2015, Wyoming PBS premiered Dick Cheney, A Heartbeat Away, produced by Jeff O'Gara. It was an in-depth portrait of the man many regard as the most powerful vice president in U.S. history, told largely in Cheney's own words. The film traced his path from Casper, Wyoming, and the University of Wyoming to the Pentagon and the White House, alongside a lifelong battle with serious heart disease. And with news of Cheney's passing this morning, we're now visiting with O'Gara about Cheney's life and legacy. Jeff, welcome back to Main Street.
Good to talk to you, Craig.
What did you think about this morning when you heard the vice president had passed away?
Well, it came to me a little bit late. I didn't see the news early in the morning. I'd been traveling, so when I learned about it, I think we all knew it was coming. Dick and Lynn Cheney both have not been in the best of health in recent years, and I guess we could have expected it. But, you know, when it does happen, it's always a bit of a shock, and you immediately start thinking back to the time when you really had a close interaction with a figure like Dick Cheney, who obviously played a fairly major role in American history. An interesting man, and someone who, as a journalist, for a long time, I felt was fairly inaccessible. He was famously taciturn, didn't like to share a lot, didn't trust the press, didn't speak very well to the press often. But I think primarily because his friend Al Simpson told him to, he cooperated with me and with Wyoming PBS to allow us to do this documentary. And in fact, what we discovered was he had a lot to say. We did, hours of interview covering everything from his, his childhood, his beginnings in Nebraska, his growing up in Wyoming, where he had some pretty wild days, and then his move into government in the Gerald Ford administration when he became the youngest chief of staff in the White House ever.
What do you recall learning from him about his hours with 9/11, chain of command, continuity of government, and his role with President Bush during that awful time in American history?
Yeah, there are a lot of things to talk about when it comes to Dick Cheney and others at that time, when it comes to questions of executive power and the reach of executive power, things we need to think about today as well. But I do think of one particular story that Cheney told me when we were just prepping for the documentary. We weren't filming, we were just having lunch one day, and he talked about 9/11. And of course, we all know at that time, the president, President Bush, was down in Texas, and they were worried about him, and they were flying him to different locations to keep him safe. Dick Cheney was back at the White House and down in the bunker under the White House, and he was the one that the military came to when, in fact, there were other planes approaching various targets and had to be dealt with. So they would come to Dick Cheney and say, what should we do? You know, there's a plane coming towards the Capitol, and it might be probably is headed for the White House or the Capitol. What should we do? Well, Dick Cheney, never a man to be indecisive, said, take it down. And there are protocols they have to follow. I think they had to ask him three times, and he said, take it down, repeatedly. So they set up planes to take it down. What he told me at lunch, though, that was a bit of a revelation, was that they got the planes aloft, the jets, to intercept that passenger plane that was coming in, manned by terrorists. And those planes discovered after they were up that they were not armed. Their armaments were not engaged. They could not have shot that plane down. That's kind of a revelation, and it's just kind of a lunch conversation. So he's got anecdotes like that in mind. Of course, we know that plane, because of a passenger revolt, was diverted and crashed in a Pennsylvania field. But, I suppose in a way that's a way that you can win the hearts of the press, is to give them a little nugget like that. But he did that very early on, and I found that in dealing with him over the course of many months and repeated interviews, that he was pretty open. He was ready to talk about a lot of things, and that was a good example of it.
You talked about his heart conditions in your documentary. And did you get a sense of how he viewed his own mortality? Because quite frankly, there were times when he was a very sick man.
Yeah, there were. And we actually dealt with his doctor as well, his heart doctor, the fellow who eventually worked out a heart transplant for him after he was out of office. Yeah, this man is a stoic. He's somebody who I think dealt with health issues most of his life. Heart conditions, he had a heart condition when he was in Congress. I mean, it didn't just come up when he was in the White House or as vice president. And I think, unlike some of us who might be fairly quick to say, I got to go see a doctor, I've got this little tickle in my throat, whatever it might be, Dick Cheney learned early to live with, I suppose you could say, a risk of sudden death at any time with the heart problems that he had. It never slowed him down. He never stopped, playing a major role. He never hid away from any kind of stressful activity. In fact, you can imagine during the Iraq War and other times when he was defense secretary, when he was vice president, he was under enormous pressure and stress, and all of that with a bad heart.
Jeff, what do you think his legacy will be even today? I've read several others comment about what they believe his legacy would be. Many of those folks had never visited with him, didn't have the access to him that you did, didn't know about him from his early days in Wyoming, clear through his days at the White House. What are you thinking about his legacy today?
Well, there's two different things. I mean, there's his personality, which I think was unique among the politicians that I've known. That's not really a legacy. His legacy is going to be very mixed, I think, and it depends probably a lot on who's writing that history. But if you look at some of the things that he was involved in, it's getting a little abstract to talk about the unitary executive, but he was a great believer in executive power and consolidated that. Actually, that went back to his days with Gerald Ford. His willingness, first as defense secretary and later as vice president, to extend the prerogatives of the executive branch to the point of stories we all know about the kinds of interrogation that were done on suspected terrorists, things that I think many consider to be beyond what the Geneva Conventions allow. Dick Cheney pushed for that and, in fact, advocated for it and always had a pretty strong feeling that the executive branch could make decisions like that and not seek either congressional approval or, for that matter, world approval through the United Nations or something. So if you think about that, one of the legacies of that, I think we can say today, is we have a lot of questions about the extent of executive power. What can a president do? What beyond the permission of Congress or the approval of Congress and the laws of the land can a president get away with? Maybe get away with is the wrong word. Dick Cheney stretched those boundaries. And it's interesting that he became something of an opponent of Donald Trump, considered him dangerous. I think what you could say about Cheney is that he believed character in office would protect us from abuses of power. And therefore, he believed in a dangerous world, the executive branch should have a lot of muscle and a lot of power to exercise it. But he always believed, I think, that we would be electing people who would use that power wisely. Obviously, from his objections to some of the activities in the current administration, you could say that he may have been proven wrong on that front.
Jeff, we have about a minute left. If you had one more sit down with the former vice president, what would you ask?
Oh, gosh. You know, I would say, what would you wish for this country going forward? In other words, what kind of a role would you see it playing in the world other than the sort of world policeman that it's been? And given all the power that's concentrated in the United States, what do we do to protect the constitutional rights and just the freedoms of the people in this country that have meant so much? You see that embodied somewhat in the debates that his daughter Liz has been involved in. I think this mattered greatly to Dick Cheney, even though he will often be portrayed as somebody who in some ways lowered those standards.
You can look at Jeff O'Gara's production of Dick Cheney, A Heartbeat Away on PBS.org. And my guest has been Jeff O'Gara. He's the producer of the 2015 Wyoming PBS documentary. It was a first-person account of a Wyoming life that reached the pinnacle of Washington power. Jeff, thanks for your remembrance of Vice President Cheney.
Greg, it's always fun to talk to you. Take care.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents Masterworks 2, Music from Within, with works by Mozart, Stravinsky, and Bloch, and performance by Maestro Christopher Zimmerman on piano, and Principal Flute Deb Harris. November 8th and 9th at NDSU Festival Concert Hall. Details at fmsymphony.org.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Apple cider is a fall staple. It's also a tasty side effect of grizzly bear management on the Flathead Indian Reservation. Picking apples means there's less food to attract bears. The Mountain West News Bureau's Hannah Merzbach takes us to Northwest Montana.
It's a big day for Carrie Kingery, her husband, and their toddler, Henry. It's the two-year-old's first time picking apples.
You ready to pick apples, Henry?
Yeah. Carrie parks her car on the side of a relatively busy road right outside Ronan on the Flathead Indian Reservation, about an hour and a half south of Glacier National Park. There's fields of dry grass here, with the Mission Mountains towering above.
We'll unpack here, and the trees that we'll be picking today are just along the road.
Carrie's a member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes and leads the tribe's wildlife program. She and her family are out here to pick enough apples to make a few jars of cider. But the effort solves another problem. Homesteaders brought apple trees to the region in the early 1900s, and they spread from there. And bears love apples.
So you'll see a lot of times in urban areas, in open fields or along the road, you'll find random apple trees that will draw them in and then, you know, have them be right next to homes.
Across the West, wildlife managers are looking for ways to reduce conflict between bears and humans. For about 5 years, Carrie has helped run a program that connects landowners with hundreds of people who want to harvest excess apples. Montana's State Wildlife Department also promotes fruit harvesting to keep bears safe. And a cider company in Jackson, Wyoming does too.
We get calls every fall if we don't get our fruit gleaning equipment out fast enough because their trees are ready.
Carrie's husband, Hugh, picks up the apple picker, a long red stick with a little cage on top, and starts plucking fruit. The tree is covered with it.
There's almost no pressure required whatsoever. They're just ready to pop right off.
The family drops the apples into a laundry basket. Henry waddles around, double-fisting apples.
Apple.
They fill the basket in a quick 20 minutes and hit a couple more trees on their way back to the car. Then head to a fall festival down the street to use a cider press there.
Henry, can you say bye-bye?
Bye-bye, apple. Bye-bye, apple.
Carrie says compared to other parts of the region, people are more tolerant of grizzlies because indigenous people and bears have coexisted here for a long time. The tribe's program is designed to ensure that healthy relationship continues.
This area has, even with non-tribal members, have always had a grizzly bear presence in the area. They were never fully extirpated or eradicated. We know that this has always been the bear's home. They created this area for us to live and flourish, and so there's that respect there.
She says that respect is the basis for how the Salish and Kootenai tribes manage wildlife. Hunting grizzlies isn't allowed in the lower 48, and the tribes want it to stay that way. But Montana, as well as neighboring states Wyoming and Idaho, are pushing to take grizzlies off the endangered species list and allow some hunting.
The grizzly bear is a species that is highly revered spiritually and culturally by the tribes, and so they have never harvested them or hunted them.
Picking and pressing apples is a fun and delicious way to coexist with bears. We're now at the Fall Festival, where residents are greeting farm animals like ducks and goats, jumping in bouncy castles, and gathered around wooden cider presses.
So right now we are loading apples into the top of the cider press. You want to put those in there?
Then Carrie turns a wheel to grind the apples, which end up in a bucket below. Next, she cranks a wooden block to compress them, and juice flows into awaiting jars.
Would you like to go first, love?
Okay.
She lifts the jar to her mouth and takes a big gulp. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Hannah Merzbach on the Flathead Indian Reservation.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Nodak Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at nodakins.com.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
How whales can help humans live longer. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Hurricane Melissa that struck in the Caribbean last week caused at least 60 deaths, most of them in Haiti and Jamaica.
The extremely powerful Category 5 storm intensified rapidly, with sustained winds reaching 185 miles per hour. It tied two other hurricanes for the strongest ever in the Atlantic.
The storm moved slowly over exceptionally warm waters, about 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit higher than average, according to Climate Central. Human-caused climate change leads to warmer waters that then produce heavier rainfall and greater flooding.
The warming in the tropics, combined with the ocean temperatures, made Melissa's top wind speed about 10 miles per hour higher and increased its damage potential by up to 50%.
An analysis of Category 5 hurricanes over the past 125 years showed a large increase recently in storms at the top of the scale, including 13 of them in the last 10 years and three this year.
A new study from the University of Konstanz in Germany showed that heart rates sync up among people fishing together.
The scientists studied a group of fishers in Brazil who collaborate with dolphins. Standing in a line near the shore, the people wait to throw out their nets until the dolphins drive the fish toward them. The dolphins dive, and then the group tosses their nets.
The people have to coordinate with each other to respond to the dolphins at just the right moment. The study found that when fishers were close together, their heart rates were highly synchronous, and that correlation was stronger when they were watching and waiting.
If a fisher acted alone, the synchronization decreased. The authors said that when people work closely together, their bodily rhythms as well as their movements and decisions match.
Surprisingly, the synchronization didn't lead to a higher catch. When the fishers' heart rates were aligned, they caught fewer fish. The researchers say the explanation could be that a high level of correlation, even when excited or tense, reduces the flexibility required for a group to succeed.
During Halloween last week, some party decorations might have featured cartoon vultures sitting in trees poised to strike.
For many ranchers around the country, vultures are no joke, black vultures specifically. The birds are showing up in new areas due to climate change and attacking livestock, especially defenseless calves shortly after birth.
Prior to the 1990s, the birds were mostly found from the U.S. Southeast to South America. Now they've expanded their range into the Midwest and up the East Coast as winters get warmer.
Ranchers who've never had to contend with vultures are trying to respond with everything from scarecrows to noise-making devices or motion-activated sprinklers.
Black vultures are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, so if farmers want to kill a bird threatening their livestock, they would need to get a permit, which could be too late to save vulnerable animals.
Earlier this year, the Black Vulture Relief Act was introduced in Congress that would remove the permit requirement, but ranchers would have to inform the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service so they can monitor populations.
Andrew Farnsworth, with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, told the Associated Press that making it easier to kill black vultures may not be a good idea, because the birds fill a super important role in cleaning up dead stuff.
According to the National Audubon Society, carcasses not scavenged by vultures decompose slowly and attract carnivores like coyotes, whose growing numbers could pose a greater threat to livestock than the birds.
Also, black vultures may not be the actual killers, but rather show up at the scene of the crime after the fact. Marion Wall at Purdue University, who coordinated a research program to gauge the scale of the problem, said the vultures do a good job of making themselves look guilty.
And finally, scientists might have solved a puzzle called Pato's paradox. It questions why some large animals don't get cancer, even though they have zillions of cells that could mutate to cause disease.
One possible answer came from researchers at the University of Rochester studying bowhead whales, which can live over 200 years and grow to be over 62 feet long.
Human and animal DNA get damaged over time, which accelerates aging by impairing cell function and increasing the risk of developing diseases like cancer. However, the researchers discovered a cold-activated protein in bowhead whales that helps repair broken DNA.
The protein is called CIRBP. And although humans have some, bowhead whales have it in spades.
The team tested adding bowhead CIRBP to human cell cultures and fruit fly cells. In both cases, DNA repair improved, and in the fruit flies, it extended their lifespan.
However, the whales live in icy waters, which seem to trigger CIRBP production. The researchers don't know the exact temperature that would be required to ramp up the protein in humans, but speculate that things like taking a cold shower could help.
Not to pour cold water on a longevity hack, but it might be hard for some of us to give up hot showers.
That's it for This Week in Water. Support our work at h2oradio.org, where donations are doubled until December 31st.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 4th. Mary Ada Fisher was born at Somerset, Ohio on July 5th, 1888, the fourth child of John and Amida Fisher. When Mary was 10 years old, she moved with her family to North Dakota to settle the affairs of a deceased uncle. The Fisher family decided to stay and bought a homestead near Wolf Creek, where John built the Fisher store and post office, which then became known as Fisher, North Dakota. Wanting their daughter to get an education, the family sent 13-year-old Mary to St. Bernard's Academy in Grand Forks. As Mary matured, she found the strict religious environment too confining, and she rejoined her family, which had left Fisher and had moved to Omimi, North Dakota. Mary, or Marie, as she now preferred to be called, worked at the Omimi Train Depot. There she met railroad conductor Stephen Law, and the two were soon married. Marie, 17 years old, was 15 years younger than Stephen. The newlyweds lived with Stephen's overbearing spinster sister. Unable to live under those conditions, Marie fled on her own to Canada and eventually found her way to Alaska. Taking odd jobs to make her way, the petite, attractive redhead received much attention from men in the mining camps and began her life career as a soiled dove. Marie changed her name again and was now Del Burke. Her career took her to Montana and eventually to Casper, Wyoming. When Casper cracked down on alcohol and prostitution, Del moved to Lusk, Wyoming, and built a brothel known as the Yellow Hotel, where Burke became a madam to provide a safe place for young ladies to work in the world's oldest profession. Burke had a head for business, and soon the Yellow Hotel was thriving. Del bought a ranch outside of Lusk and made wise investments. She also invested in the community, sponsoring city projects, made donations to the churches, and paid scholarships for local youth. When the city commission tried to shut her down, Del reminded them that the city still owed her for financing the Lusk water and power plant. The Yellow Hotel stayed open. The famous Yellow Hotel operated from 1919 to 1978. Del Burke passed away a millionaire on this date in 1981 at the age of 93. When she died, only kind words were said, even though she had operated an illegal business in Lusk for decades. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Scott Nelson. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
And that wraps up this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, award-winning biologist and author Dr. Buranda Montgomery joins us ahead of her November 13th lecture at Concordia College to share how we can learn about growth, resilience, and community from the wisdom of plants. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.